was gripping my own knees, swiveling myself around him. He fell forward onto me finally, and we lay still together, holding each other. After a while, he said softly, "It's circular, Joe." Then he laughed. "Cyclical, I mean. It just comes around from time to time.
Howdy, remember me?"
"See, that's it," I was whispering to match his voice. "I don't want it to be circular. I want linear. I want events. I want to be blown away."
"Joey," he said tenderly.
He struck my face, put his fingers in my mouth. His hand tasted of salt and sex, his and mine. I chewed on him gently.
"Maybe if we took lots of vitamin E,"
I offered after a few moments.
"Would you want it, though?" he asked. "I like its ebb and flow. I like it to stop so it can start again."
He moved his hand.
"How can I miss you if you won't go away?"
I laughed. We shifted. After a few moments, I reached for my wine glass over Daniel's body. Then, suddenly, from the yard, we heard the voices calling, laughing. Car doors began to slam one after another. We had a little flurry of guilty activity, sitting up, fastening pants, pulling panties and socks back on, skirt down, hair smooth, shirt tucked in, and then, with an elaborately slow John Wayne walk, Daniel moved behind his desk and took his seat. I stretched out demurely on the daybed, and we looked at each other and lifted our glasses again, saluting, I think, our transformation back to the people Cass and Nora and Sadie believed in. Chapter 9. Toward the end of the party, a bunch of the young people were dancing in the corner of the living room by the stereo, one of them holding a baby of 6 or 8 months, twirling it slowly while the baby patted his face, and they laughed at each other. Allie, who loved to dance, was circling them all with a herder's nervousness, barking from time to time. The talkers were talking louder to hear one another over the noise, though the music was still fairly subdued, Latin stuff. I went to the kitchen to consolidate platters of food so I could carry them out to the living room, where almost everyone seemed to be at this point. Things had thinned out a bit, but those who had stayed seemed committed for the long haul. Mostly people I'd known for years, they were locked in conversation, in pleasant social interchange, all over the room. Here a group sitting in a cluster by the fire, there a person leaned against the wall, head bent forward and down to listen to someone else. I looked up as I was working and saw Eli standing in the kitchen doorway.
"I like your house," he said, looking around the huge room. He and Jean had arrived fairly early on, and I'd made the rounds with them, introducing them to people I thought they'd enjoy. I'd been pleased to see them moving easily around on their own after that. Eli, at one point, launched into a fierce argument with a radical friend of Nora's from high school. Jean, standing in a group of 5 or 6 people, including Mary Ellen, laughing.
"Thanks," I said now.
"It is sweet, isn't it?" "It's more or less what we imagined when we decided to come to New England. An old farmhouse with these kind of rooms opening up off each other ad infinitum beams." He gestured up at ours, darkened and cracked, hung with drying herbs from Daniel's garden.
"So why didn't you?"
"There wasn't one on the market when we were looking that didn't need lots of work. Lots of work. And we didn't want that. And then we saw the house we got. And decided new was nice, too."
"Those houses are pretty swell."
"You'll have to come over and see it, you and Daniel."
"Daniel, yes."
He nodded.
"I talked to him briefly." "He's not a minister, is he?"
"Yes, he is. Why?"
"Oh, something he said made me think that. But then I thought surely not."
"Why not?"
"Why not?"
He lifted his shoulders.
"Well," he grinned, "I don't know ministers, that's all. I guess I'm a pretty parochial person. Anyway, I was just startled to think it might be so. He gestured at the table. What are you doing here? Can I help? I want everything on these two plates, I said. I want to take it all out into the other room. I want it eaten up.
Done.
He stepped closer to me and started to work, too, piling all the little rounds of bread at the edges of the platters. After a moment, he said abruptly,
How does that affect your life?
What?
His being a preacher.
I looked over at him, but he was steadily working. I smiled. How does your wife's being a political scientist affect your life? He looked at me, too, and after a second smiled back, acknowledging the point. I said, He likes his job, and that's good for our life.
And he's a great listener. That's nice for me.
Eli nodded. Then he stopped working and turned to watch me, to watch my hands. He said, Look, I wanted to thank you for your support, for your understanding and sympathy about Arthur. His voice had changed. I straightened up.
Oh, Eli, thanks aren't necessary.
No, they are. You're a good listener, too. It meant a lot to me to have you be his vet for that moment, to have you put him down, or whatever we have to call it.
I didn't know what to say. I bit my lip.
Well, I'm touched, I managed. I reached out and set my hand on his arm and felt again the thick massiveness of Eli, the unexpected heat. We stood there for a moment. He was looking down at me, and I was aware, as I never was with Daniel, of feeling small, of feeling very female. Then I moved my hand away. I turned and began to work again. He said, It's an odd kind of bond, wouldn't you say? It's as though we'd committed some kind of crime together.
Eli, no, I cried.
I'd stood up straight.
No, not at all. You mustn't feel guilty about it.
No. It's as though we've endured the death of a friend together. That's all.
I know. I know you're right.
I turned away from his gaze. It was too serious, too open for me.
And we have endured the death of a friend, haven't we?
He was standing very close to me. His voice was deep, intimate.
I mean Dana, he said.
I felt a kind of thrill, the near dizziness you get when someone first speaks of love. I lifted my hand to my throat and swallowed. I said,
I'm so glad to have you speak her name.
Sometime.
It will be good to talk about all that.
Yes. I turned and began to bend and reach over the table again, sliding the last wedges of cheese onto the platter.
I've been feeling... Please, Joe. I wanted you to know this, that if I had to meet someone from that time again, it should be you.
Now I looked hard at him.
Thanks, I think. Thanks, I said.
He laughed quickly and stepped back. I picked up one platter, and he followed me into the living room, carrying the other. He and Jean left shortly after that. At the door, she'd promised they'd have us to their house soon. Maybe a light supper next week, before the holiday rush started.
Lovely, I said.
They turned and waved under the porch light as they started across the snowy yard. The kids had definitely jacked the music up in the living room by now, and their dancing had gotten wilder, claimed more space. Finally, the adults retreated to the kitchen, those who were left. A familiar core of us, a group that had had babies at the same time, that had traded childcare and sat in each other's yards at summer barbecues until there was no light left, or in one another's kitchens on winter nights, reluctant to end the evening, to drive home down the empty snowy roads. We talk now of the town elections, of the scandalous breakup of a friend's marriage, of the lives and doings of the nearly grown-up children in the next room. Shortly after midnight, the last two couples left together. Daniel went into the living room and announced he was cleaning up. Several of the kids helped, and then slowly they began to drift away too. The music was soft now. As I undressed, I could hear the voices calling goodnight in the yard, the whumps of the car doors. It was around 1:30 when I climbed into bed next to Daniel. I was thrumming with energy still, wildly alert. "It was a nice party, wasn't it?" I said. I heard a really funny discussion with Mary Ellen and some others about Watergate at one point. Watergate, can you believe it? I began to recount it to him. He made no response. I stopped and after a moment said, "You're not too interested in this, are you?" "I'm interested, Joe. Tomorrow I'll be interested. I have to sleep now." "I can't yet." "Get the light, though, will you?"
He was frowning, his eyes shut. I flicked the light off and lay in the dark. My ears were ringing as though I'd been on an airplane. And indeed, I felt that way after the noise and energy of the party, a kind of traveler's speedy dizziness. I wasn't ready yet to be lying here, to sleep. I got up and shut the door as quietly as I could behind me. The murmur of the girls' voices pulled me through the darkened living room to the kitchen. They were sitting at the table with the overhead light on. It looked like a painting framed by the kitchen doors. They laughed as one, the same uplifted faces. Then I saw that Cass was smoking. I resolved to say nothing, though it was a house rule that she shouldn't inside. But I didn't want to interrupt what seemed their easy familiarity. I didn't want to give her a reason to be angry with me tonight. Nora's eyes focused on me in the doorway.
"Mumster," she announced. They all looked over. "Hey, are you pleased with your party, Mommy?" Sadie asked.
She was already in a nightgown. The other two were still dressed.
"Of course. Are you?
Did enough good things happen?" I pulled out a chair and sat down with them.
Sadie said. "I'll say. I got to dance with Ivan Baloff, the hunkiest hunk of honey here."
"No way," said Cass.
"I did too. And not just once, a bunch of times we were hot. I mean, no way was he the hunkiest hunk."
"Well, who was then?" Sadie asked.
Cass thought for a moment.
"I'd have to vote for Guy Talbot," she said.
"Guy Talbot," I cried.
This was one of our friends, a real mope.
"But he's such a gloomy gus, Cassie. He's like a character out of Dostoevsky. He's always in some kind of agony."
He was handsome, though. I realized that suddenly. Handsome in a way that didn't matter in the least to me.
"But see, I love that," Cass said. "I love tormented guys."
"Well, you won't later," I said. And instantly regretted it. I could feel Cass bristle. Her eyebrows arched aristocratically.
"Oh, I think I will," she said coolly.
"I have earlier, and I think I will later." "Oh, how do you know, Cass?" asked Nora. She was smiling at me and Sadie.
"I know," Cass said. She turned to me. "See, I'm just not interested in what you and Dad have, in a safe life," she said. "In sweetness and light."
She made a fist and brought it down on the table. The glasses and dishes jumped and she smiled. Her lips were still a deep brown red.
"I want things to be hard," she announced.
"Things will be hard. You don't have to want them to," I said.
"Yeah," Nora said. "Hard is easy to get. It's when you want things to be good. When you want all sweetness and light, that you understand what's really hard."
She was the grown-up talking to the child.
"Well, if you mean boredom is hard, I'll agree with you there."
Cass drew fiercely on the last of a cigarette, her cheeks pulling in, and began to crush it in a coffee saucer. She turned her face away slightly to blow her smoke out.
"What are you suggesting, Cass?" Nora said.
Her face was flushed.
"That what I wanted with Brian is boring? That mother's life with Daddy is boring?"
Cassie's green eyes flickered from face to face. She nervously pulled another cigarette out of the pack lying on the table and began to tap it. She shrugged suddenly. She was backing away from the argument.
"It's just not for me, that's all.
She sounded infinitely superior.
No, Nora said, no. You'd rather fuck in the van in some dark alley with three guys sitting there watching it all.
There was a long, terrible silence. I could feel Sadie looking quickly from one of us to another. Finally, Cass stood up. She stretched lazily, an unfolding of long bones.
You should try it sometime, Nora. It adds a certain zing. It ain't boring anyway.
She turned at the door and pointed her unlighted cigarette at her twin.
By the way, remind me, sweetie, never to confide in you again.
We heard her shoes clunk across the living room up the stairs. I looked over at Nora. She looked slapped, white around the eyes. She caught me watching her and turned away quickly. Her chair made a scraping noise as she stood, and two of the sleeping dogs jumped up and swam around her.
She never changes.
Her voice was trembling.
I should never have come home.
And she, too, walked out of the room. For a long moment, Sadie and I sat staring at each other. Her hair was wet and lank with sweat. Her makeup had worn off. She looked about 10 years old. She raised her eyebrows.
Sowee, she said.
Yikes, I answered. I put my face in my hands and rubbed my eyes. Maybe both those things are true, I said. That Cass will never change, and that Nora shouldn't have come home.
Wouldn't that be awful? Don't feel bad, Mom. They'll get over it.
She had a little wine left in her glass, and now she finished it, leaning her head all the way back. I saw the flick of her tongue.
What were you guys talking about before I so rudely interrupted? Nothing really, just the party.
She set the glass down.
Who was cute? Who likes who? Etc.
Chemistry sure hit the fan when I arrived.
Well, it always does,
she said cheerfully, as though reassuring me of something.
It always does, I cried. Yes, you know that.
I do?
Yeah. It's because they're both so jealous about you. That's my theory anyway.
Of me?
Duh, Mom.
Yes, of you.
Why me?
Because you're so...
She tilted her head, made a face.
Elusive, you know. Dad is just always there, the same. Steady as a rock and all like that. And you're different.
You find me elusive?
Well, I don't, but that's me. They do. But it's like neither of them can admit it, so they kind of vie for you, or with each other or something.
I picked up the saucer with Cassie's cigarette butts, two of them, and took it over to the trash can. When I came back, I announced, if I thought I caused their antagonism to each other, I'd kill myself. If I thought I seemed elusive to my children, I'd kill myself. I sat down. Sadie was immune to my histrionics.
Well, you have to admit you're secretive. Sadie, I am not. I always tell the truth. You guys can ask me anything. Okay, fine. How's this?
She leaned forward.
You lived with Jean's husband?
Oh, that. Sadie laughed. And I did too for a few seconds, sheepishly.
You make me laugh, she said.
So I see.
Well? Well, that was years ago. Obviously, I was in a group house with him, that's all. A kind of quasi-commune of the 60s. Before you were married?
No, I was married then to Ted, but I'd left him for a while. There was a quick puff of exasperated breath.
See what I mean?
I left him twice, actually, poor man.
God, Mom!
She protested. Well, that first time it was a kind of experiment. When I was in the group house, and then I went back, and then I left him again for good, because I'd learned something from the experiment, that I couldn't live with him anymore. But that was when I knew Eli. I was about, I was 22, a little older than your age.
But he wasn't like your boyfriend or anything?
Her voice said, please don't tell me that.
I was married, Sadie. I didn't let myself have a boyfriend.
After a moment, she frowned and said, so when exactly did you meet Dad? They all knew the part of the story that had me and Daniel meeting at an airport when I was still married to someone else, that had me calling Daniel 3 years later when I was divorced. I'd used it too many times when they mooned over boys as adolescents, hoping to be chosen, hoping to be called. The last time, I'd barely begun the tale when Nora said, don't, Mom, we all know, and she chanted it. You were the one who picked up the phone and called Dad. I told Sadie, a longer version now, about my confusion in running away from Ted, about my staying out of touch with him and my mother for all those months, about my return, my leaving again for Maine, my depression, and then my finding my way to my work, to her father, to the life that brought us here in the middle of a cold New England night to this room, this table, this story. I didn't talk about Dana, though. I'm not sure why. I saw her face as I was speaking. She was especially in my mind, of course, because of seeing Eli and talking to him at the party, because he'd brought up her name at last. I'd thought of her earlier, too, at the moment when Cass seemed to be suggesting I'd led a boring life. I thought of her and knew I would say nothing. I would not use the drama of Dana's random, senseless murder to make myself seem more interesting to my difficult daughter. I think that I was also aware that Sadie might have heard a great deal in the last few days from Cass and Nora about what was hard, as Cass put it, in their lives, and I didn't feel I needed to add the terrible lesson from my life to all that. So I didn't speak of Dana or her death. The house was still. The dogs and people were all sound asleep when Sadie and I stood at the foot of the stairs and said goodnight, whispering.
I love talking to you, Mom.
She reached out and hooked my hair behind my ear. Do you, Sadie? I was surprised and moved by her sweetness, by her willingness to touch me. She said.
And thanks for inviting Jean to the party. That was great.
Then she hoisted her nightie slightly, like a 19th-century belle lifting her long skirts, and turned, and I watched the bottoms of her grimy white bare feet winking up the ladder-like stairs. It was about a week and a half later that Daniel and I went to hear Cass and her band play. She'd hit the road again the Saturday after Thanksgiving with the last flurry of gigs. Providence was the closest venue, and we'd promised to show up there. After we'd found the place and parked, Daniel cut the engine, and we sat silent for a moment. Then he said, I wonder who it is that books a place like this. How do they even know about them? The street was empty, littered, completely cheerless. The neighborhood surrounding it was full of triple-deckers with aluminum or asphalt siding. Sodium vapor light fell on everything with an unhealthy orange glow. Here and there, a collapsing porch roof was propped up with some long pieces of raw lumber. The plate glass windows in the storefront next to Al Priest's, the bar Cassie was playing in, were papered on the inside with long, faded banners reading, Everything must go! Bargains galore! On the other side was a locksmith's shop, and on the corner a small bodega, closed for the night, with a faint fluorescent light glowing somewhere deep within. They were probably grateful to get the gig. Providence must be big time for them, wouldn't you think? I'd been feeling irritated with Daniel for the last few days, ever since our dinner at Eli and Jean's. The evening there had been uncomfortable, so much so that Daniel had announced afterward that if I wanted to see Eli Mayhew again, I should do it on my own. I blamed Daniel for the way it had gone. I was annoyed at him. There was a raw rain falling outside. There had been for the whole drive east. Now that our wipers were off, it blurred our view of the street. Here we go, I said. A group of people was approaching. You could hear their voices drawing nearer under the reins thrumming on the car. A girl shrieked with laughter. There were six or seven of them. A few had umbrellas, but most were in parkas with the hoods pulled forward, hiding their faces. "Come on," I crooned to them all. "Come to Cassie." They did. They stopped at the bar. And when they opened the door, there was a confusion of music and voices that floated out to us.
"Gee, it's alive in there anyway," Daniel said.
"Let's go. At least now we know we won't be the first." I'd started to move away from the car when Daniel called over to me.
"Lock it."
He was right, of course. It was a rough neighborhood. But somehow I felt annoyed with him for thinking of it and for his peremptory tone. One in a series of what I knew very well were petty grievances I could have been said to be collecting against him over the last few days. He stood up one evening in the middle of something I was saying to him and began to pick up the bits of wet leaf one of the dogs had tracked into the living room. I overheard him on the phone passing judgment on a movie we'd seen in exactly my words, without crediting me. Even the blood-specked tissues stuck on a shaving cut one morning got on the list. And the familiar, theatrical groan as he rose from a living room chair. I knew these were absurdly small-minded. I knew they weren't, in some sense, real. I knew anyone could have made a similar list about anyone else. About me, for instance. I knew. But somehow, once I started, I couldn't stop myself. The club was warm and cheerfully noisy as we entered, the sound like a thick substance you move through, combination of canned music and shouted conversation. The room was long and narrow. There was a bar running along one side, up to where, on a lighted raised platform, the mics and stools and drums were set up. A solitary, fat bass rested against the wall. The place was two-thirds full, mostly with young people, sitting jammed in at the little round wooden tables. A few people were at the bar. Singletons, I remembered from my waitress days. The jukebox was playing a loud song, hard and driving, and anti-melodic, a male voice shouting the lyrics, an accusation after accusation. A lone young woman was moving dreamily on what must have been the dance floor, a small open area in front of the bandstand, looking seraphic, so at peace. She seemed to be dancing to a tune other than the one playing. Daniel and I went to the front of the room, searching for a table from which we might be able to see the bandstand easily, but they were all full up there. We decided, leaning toward each other and shouting, to sit at the near end of the bar. Better than a table, anyway, we concluded, if people were going to be dancing right in front of the musicians.
"What beer?"
Daniel yelled at me when the bartender came over and pushed napkins at us. He, anyway, seemed not to care that we were the oldest people in the room, a big-jawed man who hung his face out at us and nodded once Daniel gave him the order. The young people around us deliberately hadn't registered us, as though we were profoundly handicapped, somehow difficult or embarrassing to look at. The beer tasted wonderful, sharp and deeply bitter. I was ravenous suddenly. I asked Danny to order nuts or chips or something.
"Which?"
he yelled.
"Anything!"
I shouted back. I'd been nervous about the evening at Eli's, but it had started well enough. Jean had cut her hair, and this gave us all something immediate to talk about. She looked elegant, and I said so. It was as though she were wearing a trim, wavy cap on her head. "I hate it," Eli said. He was helping me off with my coat in the entry hall. The floor was slate, I noted, as water from our boots pooled on it. "Why do they do it?" he asked Daniel, who looked up from heeling his boots off, blank and polite.
"Women,"
Eli explained, gesturing at Jean and me.
"Why do they take what's so lovely and chop, get rid of it?"
I'd thought of Dana then, looking at herself in the mirror over the fireplace.
"Why did I do it?"
she asks me.
"We do it because it's easier," Jean had said. "Same reason men have short hair?"
Looking at her as she spoke, I realized she was as transformed as Dana had been. Everything about her could be understood differently. She suddenly had a flapper's careless glamour.
"The hell with ease," he said.
"Tell you what, grow it back and I'll brush it for you, or shampoo it, or whatever it is that makes it harder."
"Oh, Eli,
as if you were ever even here," he laughed. "I've been on the road all fall, lecturing and conferencing," he said to Daniel as we moved into the living room. I trailed Jean with the wine we'd brought. Daniel was asking Eli about his travels as we settled ourselves. There was a fire going in the large stone fireplace. I looked around. The room was huge, wainscoted to eye level with some reddish wood, cherry most likely. I sat on a black leather couch, Daniel in a deep plush chair. Jean had taken the wine from me with thanks and was pouring for us now from a bottle already open on the coffee table. Two huge abstract paintings, full of bold bands of colour, stood propped against the wall. They weren't going to fit above the wainscoting.
"I was supposed to be gathering my strength with the sabbatical," Eli was saying, "getting ready to launch myself anew. Instead, I've completely dissipated it. I shot my wad, but it's been fun," he laughed. "Hard on Jean, though."
He sat down in a chair next to the fireplace.
"Made her so mad, she cut her down hair off."
"God, the egocentrism of the guy. Here you go," she said, handing me my glass, Daniel his.
"Sometimes," she said to Eli, lifting her own glass in his direction, "a haircut is just a haircut."
Daniel laughed. His face moved into a rictus of false pleasure. He was being too polite. I sensed right away that there was something in Eli's manner, in Eli, he didn't like. Maybe that mocking, ironic tone, maybe his ease around Jean and me, a kind of possession he seemed to take of us, of the situation, the alpha male. In any case, Daniel was being over-careful, solicitous. Now he was asking what Eli was doing on the road, what he'd been lecturing on, and so I, too, found out that he was working with something called nerve growth factor, something that could regenerate damaged nerves in the brain, that the focus of his work might eventually be Alzheimer's disease or spinal injuries.
"Transport's our area."
"Transport?" Daniel asked.
"Getting the stuff where it needs to go. Right now, you have to apply it directly because the brain has such an efficient defense mechanism against toxins, and in this case, useful drugs. And that means surgery, brain surgery." He shook his head. "Which is hardly practical for a diseased population of any size. So we're looking for alternate ways."
He smiled at Daniel.
"Alternate routes. I'm the transportation planner for the brain."
He leaned forward and stirred the fire with the poker.
"If I ever get to work again."
Jean began to speak. She had questions about the town, she said. "A list, actually. Would we mind?" "No, fire away," I said. And she did. "Where do we shop for groceries? What were the best dry cleaners? Were there good local restaurants?" She'd noticed we had a piano. "Did we know a tuner? A dentist?" We gave her information. Told tales on our neighbors. The dentist who'd survived a midlife crisis by training as a lay therapist, who stuffed your mouth with cotton and then earnestly asked you how you felt about your sexuality, about your parents. The eccentric chef at the tiny French restaurant, who could be heard weeping in the kitchen if things were not achieving the requisite level of perfection. We moved around seemingly with ease from topic to topic through the evening. The party at our house, who the various guests were, my work, Arthur, dogs in general, dogs versus cats, Adams Mills, Jean's and Sadie's school. Throughout it all, Daniel maintained his civility, the reserve I'd noted earlier. "Do tell," he said once, and I raised my eyebrows and made a face at him. If I could make him laugh at himself, maybe he'd notice how ridiculous he was being, maybe he'd relax. "Do tell," I wanted to say, but I didn't dare. Halfway through dinner, Eli turned to him.
"Joe tells me you're a preacher."
That's right.
That's an interesting line of work. I watch Daniel's thin smile. I'm wondering how you got into it.
Oh, I suppose in many ways it was similar to how you got into your line of work. I tensed. Eli laughed.
I doubt it. But I'll bite, he said. What do you mean?
Daniel shrugged. I felt compelled. I took courses. I got more interested. I went on to graduate school and got my degree. There's not much else to do once you have a D-min. Eli nodded. Then he leaned forward, elbows on the table.
See, it's the feeling compelled in the first place that I find fascinating. That really interests me. How does that happen?
Daniel set down his knife and fork and looked over at Eli. You're asking about a call or a revelation, I think.
Yes, I am.
Sorry to disappoint, but I had none. No scales falling from my eyes. Daniel's tone was dismissive, but Eli didn't hear that. It occurred to me for the first time that he might be a little obtuse about people.
Well, what then?
Nothing very dramatic at all. Just a slowly increasing sense of belief of myself as a believer, as someone who wanted to make that central in his life.
But belief in what? That's what I wonder, in the soul?
Eli's voice gave this italics. He did not, you could tell, believe in the soul. Among other things, the soul, yes, Daniel said. Looking back, I would remember his face then, its clarity, its wholeness.
Aha,
Eli said. He seemed really delighted. This new, middle-aged Eli loved to talk, too.
But what if I told you that thought, feeling, personality, even faith, are a matter of neurons?
Neurons firing in specific learned pathways in the brain.
That's what the soul is. That's all. You can extinguish any of it with a single knife cut or a blow to the head.
I'd say that had nothing to do with what I was talking about.
But look, what I'm saying is that God is an idea, a human idea. He resides in the particular arrangement of the matter in your brain. Change the matter and presto, God is gone.
Daniel cleared his throat. He said, And what I'm saying is that I agree you might be able to eliminate my belief by altering my brain. But that doesn't mean God is gone.
But where else does he live but in your brain? Your brain and other brains that have been deliberately structured the same way. You're a smart man, you see that. He's an idea, like the idea of life after death.
His hand circled, he smiled. Or the virgin birth. His smile widened.
Eli,
Jean began.
No, he doesn't mind explaining this.
Eli turned to Daniel.
Do you?
There's nothing to explain, Daniel said. I'm not explaining.
Ah, I've offended you. I didn't mean to. Look, why not see me as a candidate for conversion?
His hand rose and rested on his own chest.
I mean, here I am, a lost soul, a non-believer. Why not try to convince me, persuade me? Why not save me? That's what your faith is about, isn't it? Harvesting souls?
He was completely genial in this, but there was the quality of assumption that we could all treat this as he did, lightheartedly, a kind of intellectual joke. I looked over at Daniel. His face was tight. If that were what my faith was about, what I'd say to you is that you're not ripe. Eli missed the metaphor. He looked puzzled. Daniel went on. There has to be some need, some desire even for God. Maybe just some sense of something missing in your life. And I don't think you feel that. Daniel sat back in his chair. I'm sure, actually, that you don't. At last, Eli heard it, the dismissal in Daniel's tone. His face shifted. He too sat back.
No, he said. No, you're right. I don't.
Eli, Jean said brightly, lives in his own universe. Some men are like that. Here's the evidence. We married 4 years ago, and Eli was then 52 and had never been married, never even lived with anyone except Arthur, of course. It's a wonder he ever did marry. He would like me to consider it a miracle. She laughed brightly and turned to me, clearly inviting me to join her, to help her shift the course of events. She asked me now about the Holtz, the former owners of the estate. We talked about their grand house, divided into expensive condos. We talked about condos versus houses, about the problems of new construction versus old construction. She was good at this, good at talking, at acting. It must be part of what Sadie admired about her as a teacher. I followed her lead. There were stories about our house to offer, the annual spring flood in the earthen basement, the beautiful old bottles and jars of aged, mysterious fruits and vegetables in the root cellar, left at some time in the distant past. Eli, and then finally Daniel, joined us. And we all moved away from danger, back to what didn't matter so much. We made our way carefully through the evening until Daniel and I could decently excuse ourselves and leave. The stage went black now, though in the dim lights from the bar and the glowing jukebox, we could easily see the band members coming out onto it. They picked up their instruments. The room quieted slightly. Cass moved to the front of the stage and stood with her guitar slung low at hip level. Her hair had grown a little. It was the length of what we'd call a pixie cut when I was young. She wore a short-sleeved shirt, tiny and pale, with a row of glittering buttons down the front. Her long arms looked fleshless, skeletal, made me aware suddenly that wrists were knobs. Her hip bones jutted above her jeans in the bare space between them and the too short shirt. Her navel was exposed. She stamped her foot twice, the lights went up, and abruptly a wall of undifferentiated noise assailed us. A group of four or five girls immediately rushed forward and started dancing, and it was through their motions, their nervous, bouncy boxing, that I heard the beat at last, and then oriented myself in the din so that I could separate out and get them all, the bass, guitar, drums. A guy with a sax blatted too, in quick, short phrases that tried to pull the beat a different way. Cassie's guitar threaded through the more dominant rhythm, offering, if you listen carefully, a kind of melody. And then she stepped forward and nearly rested her mouth on the mic. She began to sing. Her voice was a growl, a howl. Rich, though, rounded and complex. She sang a song she'd sung for us at home, sweetly, huskily. Here it was bluesy, primal. If you didn't want to stay with me, you could have said so, you could have said so. If you thought you had to wander free, you could have said so, you could have said so. The room shouted along with her. I watched her mouth shaping the words to several more verses, the exposed teeth, the tongue, the curled inside of her lips. Her head was tilted, her eyes were closed in agony. Her fingers moved over the guitar at her crotch as though she were playing with herself, which was probably the point. If you thought love was no good for you, you could have said so, you could have said so. If you didn't want to work to be true, you could have said so, you could have said so. By now the dance floor was jammed, an undulating mass with the odd arm flung suddenly up, the heads bobbing this way and that. Cass stamped one foot, one leg in regular rhythm. When she rested, when the band took over, she closed her eyes, and an ecstatic smile lighted her face. Or she turned and beamed on whoever was soloing, a smile of such beatific affection that I was jealous of each recipient. Now she stepped forward again. She was wailing. Instead you ran!
she sang. Sometime between dark and dawn, instead I woke up, baby, and you were gone.
Now a soft growl. I reached for you, baby, but you were gone. You could have said so. You could have said so.
The band stopped then, and she sang alone, musically, in her regretful, rich contralto.
You could have said so.
A slow, broken chord on the guitar, and the lights went off. The whistles and screams washed over them in the dark, and when the lights went up again, I saw that the flesh of her neck was silvered with sweat already, her shirt dampened under the arms. She was laughing and loving the ways of appreciation. She danced lightly under them a moment, bent her head and lifted it several times, now this way, now that. Then she turned her back to us. I heard her thumping out a beat. 2, 3, 4! And she spun around as the noise began again. The dance floor people were moving nearly against Daniel and me. I turned back to him and yelled, "She looks so happy!"
"What?"
His hand cupped his ear. We leaned together and I shrieked, "She's happy!" He pulled back, nodding. He agreed. We sat through the whole first set. Cass sang the lead in most of the songs. There was one instrumental, and on two of the other songs, the men sang. Was that Dark One Raimondo, I wondered? Or was Raimondo just a white boy with a dark name? When it was Cassie's turn, she howled and wailed and shrieked and grunted, but it was strong and powerful music if you gave yourself over to it. And her voice was the center of all of it, lifting from a growl to a clear, pure singing, and then back again effortlessly. When you watched her, it seemed it must be agony. The body hunkered to keep her mouth to the mic, her face contorted, the bobbing, skipping dance she did when she moved with the beat. But if you closed your eyes and just listened, you could hear that she was utterly in control. Her wild response to the applause after every number was a kind of agreement with it. I was great, wasn't I? She came to sit with us during the break, a towel around her neck. The crowd parted to let her pass, and followed her with eager, friendly eyes. We ordered a beer. She let me kiss her. Her shirt was soaked, her hair wetted into little points around her face. "You were wonderful, Cass," I told her. "I'm so proud." Daniel said something to her on her other side, and she turned to him. He moved over and made room for her to sit between us. But this meant, in the din, that she had to talk to one of us at a time in order to be heard and to hear. Basically, she chose Daniel, and I thought of what Sadie had said to me the night of the party, that the twins found Daniel easier. In the noisy bar, an image from another life occurred to me. Daniel, standing behind the glass storm door of our first apartment, holding both little girls as I went down the walk to work in my scrubs and sneakers. They were wailing, crying, and I could hear his murmuring voice under that, trying to make them call goodbye, trying to reassure them. I turned and made an amused grimace, which he mirrored. I could see his pale face through the glass, the squirming, miserable twins in his arms. And then I turned away. While they called to me and cried, I walked away. I went to work. And as soon as the routine of my long, hard day began, I forgot them. I forgot them. My choice, surely. Now Cass turned back to me.
"Thanks for coming, Mum."
We told her ahead of time we could only stay for one set. It would take us several hours to get home. Besides, she was leaving right after the show. She was driving to Concord, New Hampshire tonight. They had a bed there, a gig the next night. "I loved it, dear," I said. "I was so impressed."
"I think I'll be home for a few days at Christmas," she said, "if that's okay."
"More than okay."
"What?" More than okay, I yelled. Great.
Oh, good.
She slid off her stool. Well, she said, and she kissed Daniel quickly and me,
and then was gone.
The thick, snowy rain was welcome after the smokiness of the bar. The silence of the street, too. I heard our smallest noises magnified. Wetted footfall, the car door opening and then slamming, the metallic clicking of our seatbelts, the rustling of our clothes, the slow tick of the battery clock on the dashboard before Daniel started the engine.
She was really good, wasn't she? Daniel said. We were on the highway now.
She was. I loved watching her.
I'm exhausted by it, though, he said. I looked over.
Why did he have to say that?
It made me suddenly tired, too.
And before, I'd only felt exhilarated.
We drove on, not talking. I nearly dozed once or twice, turned away from Daniel, looking out the dotted windows at the whir of black trees against a bruised grey sky. I had the sensation you have as a child, that I was the one holding still while they were rushing by me going somewhere. And then I realized with a shock that snapped me wide awake that what I was feeling was a bitter sorrow with my life, a sharp envy for Cass. That I wanted to have what she was having. To have had, anyway, what she was having. That I wanted to be standing at the center of my life in hot lights, moving in ecstasy to music that crashed around me, that came from me, that linked me to others. That I wanted to be turning and dancing and laughing under the caressing waves of applause. That I wanted to be driving with a band through the rain down some nameless country road to a place I'd never been before. That I wanted to be making love slowly and elaborately in the parked van in a dark city alley, listening to the hitched breathing of the others while they sat back and watched. Chapter 10. I had lists for the holidays, and every day I tried to check off two or three items. Get pecans for baking. Order a goose for Christmas Day. Find warm slippers for Sadie. Another day, another list. For Cass, buy the second-hand jeans jacket I'd seen at the church resale shop, with a sinuous red dragon embroidered on its back. Pick up the personal stationery I'd ordered for Daniel, and get cards while there at the shop. Drop in at Leighton's for the trailing romantic shawl in the window. Far too expensive, no doubt, but then it was Christmas, and Nora had expensive taste. Beatty and I, and sometimes Mary Ellen, sat together at lunch behind the counter these wintry days, with the sign in the window turned to say closed. The boarding dogs sat rigid at our feet in case a crumb should fall their way, but the effect was of great attentiveness to our conversations. Occasionally, when I looked at them, seemingly so riveted to our easy banalities, I had to laugh. Mostly these days, we talked about how much we had to do. Beatty was making a doll's wardrobe for a favourite great-niece, and she described this to me one day in elaborate detail. The play suit with matching bloomers, the party dress, the wool coat and beret, the sundress. Two tiny pockets in the skirt, she said. And I made the most cunning little hanky that tucks into one, just the points showing, like that. She made a minuscule church steeple with the tips of her fingers. You are a good person, Beatty, I said. It's store-bought for me all the way.
Well, you're very busy, she said.
She burped daintily, her hand over her mouth. She'd been eating carrot sticks slowly, in a rabbity, swivel-jawed way. After a moment, she said, still, I think there's nothing like something you make yourself. Never one to avoid the backhanded insult. I agreed.
Edith now? She's sending people that TV shopping junk she ordered for herself. I shouldn't criticize. I'm glad to get rid of anything I can. But doesn't that seem kind of mean to you? Of course, it's all still in the boxes and the tissue and whatnot, so they'll never know. But it's not the same.
No, I said, it certainly wasn't. I moved efficiently through my days. Daniel was especially busy now,
as he always was in the church's Advent season. There were extra choir performances. There were almost nightly prayer meetings, as well as several community events to prepare for and stage, including a huge party where gifts were given out to the needy and elderly. There was a children's pageant calling for many rehearsals. The girls had always loved this. First, when they could be in it, as a shepherd, or a wise man, or an angel, or best yet, the Virgin Mary. Later, because the pageant used a live sheep and donkey, and there was the excitement of waiting for the inevitable and deeply hysterical accident. Daniel loved everything in this happy season, and he was cheerful through the long days in his slightly distracted way. And I was grateful, because for all the busyness, all the extra cooking, all the ticking off of chores to be done, what I was thinking of was Eli Mayhew, of his quick call to me the day after we saw Cass, and of next Sunday, when I would meet him for coffee. There had been some urgency in his voice, I thought, and this excited me. I wondered what it suggested, what it might lead to. Sometimes, what I imagined was simply more of what we'd glancingly already had, talk. But sometimes, I let myself think that the talk would become more private over time, even intimate. He would become a dear friend, a confidant. And our spouses? Oh, they would know about and respect our intimacy. Maybe even be mildly amused by its intensity, its power. Daniel's ill will was somehow easily vanquished in this fantasy, or never considered. Occasionally, though, my imagination offered up the more predictable outcome, an affair. I would remember touching Eli at the clinic, and again at my party. The density of his body, its heavy heat, so different from Daniel. I would see again the slow turn of his beautiful young body toward me in the steamy bathroom long ago, like a greeting. And then I would dismiss it. Coffee. Coffee and talk on a winter Sunday morning while Daniel was at church. That was all. I had suggested the Pennock Inn, two towns over. What I had said to Eli on the phone was that it was prettier and nicer than the town inn. But as soon as I hung up, I had to acknowledge that I'd chosen it mostly so he wouldn't run into people who knew us, who knew me in particular, since Eli knew hardly anyone yet. When I arrived, there were only two other tables occupied in the dining room. I checked to see that neither held someone I knew. Eli was sitting by himself next to the window overlooking the falls. He'd been watching for me. He waved as soon as the hostess pointed him out, as soon as my eyes fell on him. I was late. Sadie had called just as I was leaving the house. As I sat, I was apologizing breathlessly. I explained further as I removed my coat, as he signaled the waitress, as I ordered my first cup of coffee and he his second. I was, in fact, babbling, talking about Sadie, her adoration of Jean, her need to be in touch often this first year of college. Behind him, through the crazed, bubbled panes of old glass, I could see the gun-colored waterfall rushing down between ice-covered rocks. He is watching me steadily, and when I finally slowed down, he said, "You're nuts about your kids, aren't you?" I shrugged. "That's what it means to have kids, I think." He smiled. "Oh, I don't know. A lot of people complain about them." "Oh, but most of that is stylized, don't you think? People like to grouse. And of course, adolescence is tough on everyone."
"But you survived that."
I laughed. "Well, we're not out of the woods yet." The waitress brought my coffee and refilled Eli's cup. We waited. When she'd left, he said,
"I regret it."
He shook his head. "No kids."
"Do you? Well, you married so late."
"I did.
It was hard, surprisingly hard." He smiled mockingly. "To find an absolutely perfect person."
"I congratulate you." I raised my cup. "She is perfection. I know this from Sadie, and it's plain, of course, as the nose on my face." I sipped the coffee.
It was not quite warm enough.
Well, as it happened, she is perfect for me.
Which means? He looked up in surprise. He saw it was a serious question, and his mobile face screwed up in thought.
Well, I guess that Jean and I have a certain distance from each other. That sounds cold, and I don't mean it to, but each of us has his life, a very separate life. We're used to being solitary. We each lived alone for so long. We leave each other room. A lot of room. It is distance.
He lifted his hands. He was wearing an expensive-looking, loosely woven tweed jacket.
Maybe that's a privilege of the childless marriage.
It might be. I tilted my cup slightly back and forth in its saucer and watched the surface of brown liquid shift. Somehow, over the years, Daniel and I have become, I don't know, sort of mired in each other. I cannot notice him too easily. It's as though we're two halves of something. I looked up at him. You know what I liked? I liked the way Jean stood off from you a little the other night, made fun of you in a way, and spoke of you theatrically, I guess, certainly distantly, so she could make us all more comfortable when you and Daniel were headed for that little explosion. Oh, Daniel never explodes. Contretemps. Let's say contretemps.
Well, if we must.
I laughed too loudly. It sounded harsh and artificial in the nearly empty room. And the three women at the table closest to us looked over and then leaned in to speak to each other. I shifted in my chair. Anyhow, I said, I admired the way she pulled that off. Daniel would never put up with my speaking of him so distantly in his presence.
What would he do?
Oh, step forward, speak for himself, correct me, I don't know. I felt suddenly uncomfortable. I'm not criticizing him, just trying to say how things are different in our marriage. I shrugged. We both looked away at the falling, foamy water. Distantly through the window, you could hear its steady thunder. When Eli spoke again, his voice was lowered.
You must be wondering why I called you.
I looked over at him. His eyes were on me, those eyes that used to watch and watch. They seemed smaller now, less needful, more amused. It made him look less soulful than he had looked in the past, but sexier.
Well, yes, a bit, I said.
He leaned forward.
But seeing me, meeting me again, must have done the same thing for you that it did for me.
I blushed. I could feel the heat in my face, a sudden parch in my eyes.
Maybe so, I said.
Perhaps he had been imagining, too, the various ways our relationship might play out. But then he smiled and said,
it brought back that whole time, which I'd felt I'd left pretty much behind.
After a beat, I said,
and that's what you wanted to do, to leave it behind? God, yes.
He laughed with his mouth closed, a funny snorting sound.
Didn't you?
Well, of course I had. I had rushed from it into all that I had now. And then only slowly began to yearn back. I shrugged.
I loved it, in a way. I mean, I know it ended so badly for all of us, but I felt so free, so carefree, relatively speaking. I suppose mostly what I'm saying is that I felt young. Young and passionate and a little reckless.
See, I hated all that. His face, registering feeling so transparently, shifted, grimaced, as though he'd tasted something sour.
Feeling so at the mercy of all that. Did you? Were you at its mercy? I never thought of you that way.
I had thought of him as exactly the opposite.
Careful, steady,
gray. An image of his face across the dining room table occurred to me, watching us with his steady, calm eyes, watching.
Very much. Very much. And I wanted everything, he laughed. To be loved, but to be alone. Because I was only truly comfortable by myself. To be great in science, but not to be, God forbid, a scientist. I think I mentioned that before, how agonized I was, torn, really, about all that. I mean, I loved science, but I could tell it cut me off from the world I wanted to be in. From all of you, certainly, he looked out the window. My problem was, I could understand that, too, or at least understand where it came from, that sense of science as betrayer. I mean, with Dow Chemical and the napalm and the sense of imminent nuclear disaster, everything was in the air, generally.
He smiled grimly at me now and made a fist in the air.
But it also pisses me off now just to think about it, the stupid anti-scientific romanticism of that era.
He frowned for a moment.
I think that might be part of why I react so badly now to people like your husband, like Daniel. Smart people who won't accept the implications of science into their thinking.
I started to say something to defend Daniel,